Hello, this is Krista Farova. Welcome to another episode of the Strategy Skills Podcast. Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It is a free download. You can get it on firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you're looking to advance your career and need to update your resume, you can get McKinsey and BCG winning resume. It is also free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. And Firms Consulting is FIRMS Consulting. Today we have with us Paul Stonik. Paul is the Vice President of SCAD Pro, Savannah College of Art and Design's in-house design research and innovation studio, which is generating innovative designs and products for the world's most influential brands, such as Google, Amazon, and Apple. SCAD is number one in the US according to Art and Objects 2023 Best Art Schools ranking, with additional top rankings for degree programs in interior design, architecture, film, fashion, design, media, and more. Welcome, Paul. So great to have you with us.
No, thank you, Chris, for having me today. Appreciate it.
Paul, you had an exciting career. You had senior roles at Bloomingdale's and Home Depot. You were global head of user experience at Barclays Investment Bank. And you started your career at MTV. So such a fascinating, interesting career, very diverse background. Maybe we could just go through your career and you could share with us some of the experiences and what it taught you in terms of how to be an effective leader and deliver significant value for your customers, clients, and also for your organization.
No, absolutely. And I like to call my background tradigital in the work that I've done in terms of design experience, 17 years of creative team leadership, delivering award-winning work. And to your point, I did start my career at MTV in the late 90s. So I started back when the magic was written in the mid 90s in terms of studying web design and web development. But as I think about my career, it's really, I grew up in e-commerce, 18 years in e-commerce across fashion, beauty, home improvement, and automotive, banking, entertainment, 15 years in executive design leader roles. I worked for a small company, the Home Depot. You probably heard of it. So leading to the fifth largest e-commerce site and for a mobile app where we grew revenue over 3 years from $700 million to $2 billion. My work has been featured in multiple news outlets, research organizations like Forrester and L2 Gartner, national television spots, multiple Apple WWDC keynotes. And after 20 years in large corporations, I was part of this entrepreneur exodus. And I joined an automotive startup leading design and product where we were later acquired by a larger automotive company. And after the win of being acquired, most of us were laid off just a few months later, which was the beginning of the tech layoffs back in 2022. So I had a relationship with SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design, for about 5 years in different capacities. So whether it was hiring interns, doing UX masterclasses, career days, or engaging in a SCAD Pro as a client, SCAD saw my post in terms of getting laid off and approached me about running SCAD Pro. And frankly, that was the most interesting and inspiring opportunity that was out there at that time as I thought about act three of my career and grooming the next generation of design leaders further up in the funnel at the higher education level. Well, that's really meaningful and exciting work. But as I think about the things that made me successful in my career in terms of design, it was really enabling design as strategy, you know, so fighting the process and the good fight of pushing uphill in terms of making design a strategy and less about design as process, or really being known as the team that makes logos and t-shirts. Because when you're known as that team, then you're in a beauty contest at that point. And it really becomes not necessarily valuable in terms of the work that you're doing. So really getting design as strategy and how it does affect the bottom line, becoming a much different conversation in terms of how you get buy-in support and really speaking the language that leaders want to hear about and how design provides business value. So the work has to connect back to some sort of KPI, investment, broader strategy, and it can't be done in a vacuum.
Definitely cannot be done in a vacuum. So let's not pass by your career. I think it's just so important that we make a few stops along the way before we get to your current experience. So let's start with MTV, because MTV experience would be very, very unusual for our audience. And now, especially with the benefit of all other experiences you had along the way, now looking back at that MTV experience, what do you feel it taught you that helped you become even better leader?
It really taught me how to cut my teeth, right? So it was really in 1998, this was the beginning of the magic. And it was my first gig in this world. So it was really the start of my corporate career. And I didn't really know anything about anything at that point. So I was in the trenches doing MTV News, MTV Online, the movie awards, you know, doing this kind of in-production work, direct HTML and digital design and video digitization was all new world to me. So it was really more about learning. And so as I translate that to leadership, and the way I think about leadership is that you can lead from anywhere you are. Leadership is not a position or a title, it's a choice. And so even though it was the beginning of my career, I had a choice to make in terms of how I was going to lead. And so building into my soft skills in terms of listening, EQ, being strategic where I could, making decisions, these are all good, important leadership roles. So, and it also allowed me the opportunity to observe other leaders as well. Being new, entry-level role, I can observe other leaders in terms of how they manage, how they led, what were their styles in terms of taking teams forward, how did they mentor, how did they coach, how did they give feedback. So a lot of it for me was being a sponge and absorbing what was around me at that time, because everything was so fast moving. You're right on the edge of the dot-com boom and bust. It was a whole new world. So everything was moving at a million miles an hour, but it was really a wonderful opportunity to get started. And there was always something exciting happening at MTV. This was the days of TRL, Total Request Live, and it was the days of NSYNC and Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys. It was insanity every single day at work, but it was also a lot of fun.
Well, and while at MTV, did you consider just to stay in entertainment for the rest of your career?
No, it was a fun place to be, and I always dreamt of working at MTV in some capacity, and so I had this opportunity. Then eventually I moved on from there, and this was part during the dot-com boom and bust. I joined a webcasting company called Jump Cut. And so we all thought this was going to be the gravy train. This was even before YouTube. We were doing webcasting before some of the other platforms we know today. For example, we were webcasting Woodstock 2 and Elton John's AIDS fundraiser, Bill Clinton's town hall. I mean, there were big programs that we were doing before broadband, before YouTube. So we all thought this was going to be the next big thing. And much like other dot-com booms and busts that went belly up pretty quick because it was poor leadership, poor management of money, not fiscally responsible, people riding on scooters and free lunch and everything else, that company went under. And so as I started looking for my next role, I was able to land a role at Bloomingdale's. And so there I started out as a web designer in 2003, and I was the only web designer doing that type of work. There were five people on the entire team building the e-commerce site for Bloomingdale's, which was a $0 business at that time. To think about that time in 2003, Macy's was the king of the internet, just to kind of put things in perspective. So 2003, you have Macy's as king of the internet. Basically, Bloomingdale's was riding on Macy's infrastructure, and we were just reskinning it, but we had so much to learn from Macy's because they were doing so well. We grew that business from a $0 business. We were happy with a $5,000 week and 150 products that we launched. We're like, this is great. This is amazing. But then we scaled that to $100 million. We became the number one store in dresses and swim. We were beating out the 59th Street store as well. This was something to look at. So as Bloomingdale's took this hockey stick ride, so did my career in terms of what I was learning, the team that I was building. I went from one person to 10 people. The whole department went from 5 people to 100 people. We were scaling at an exponential rate. So I like to say that I grew up in e-commerce. That was my first taste of e-commerce and what it was, but I caught the wave at the right time when the e-commerce explosion started to really happen. So I'm really grateful for that opportunity because I learned a lot, cut my teeth, learned a lot about leadership, and also developed a team while I was there. And moreover, I had the opportunity to work with a really wonderful mentor. It was really my first mentor in my career, who taught me a lot about business, taught me a lot about the fashion industry and luxury industry as well, and became a really good friend too. And he was instrumental in my career, and I learned so much from him.
What are some of the key lessons you could share with us from your mentor that really changed the way you view life or business or leadership?
Yeah, there were really two key points. I think one was being inclusive and making sure that everybody's included when you're working in design solutions. And great ideas can come from anywhere. So bringing people into the room to have the conversation, to talk about what problem are we trying to solve. But moreover, it was about telling the story, right? And so you had to really be an advocate for yourself and manage large organizations. So he had great organizational savvy. So learning how to maneuver within large organizations, build alliances, find the right people, and tell the story up in terms of What are you building? What are your outcomes? What are you delivering? And being able to tell that story in the right way. Make the slides, tell the story, book the time, share your story with leadership.
Do you remember a particular maybe defining moment during your time at Bloomingdale's that really got your career moving at a faster pace?
I would say when Bloomingdale's merged with Bloomingdale's Direct, right? So Bloomingdale's Direct was the catalog version of Bloomingdale's. And it was this moment in time where Bloomingdale's strategically said, we're going to convert that to a completely online business. So I was in the right place at the right time when that happened, when they were really investing in the online business. So there was a very strategic move and I happened to be there. And that's where I realized I needed to hire a team. So that was the difference in terms of going from $5,000 a week to $1 million a week, and also building a team from 1 to 10, and really having the opportunity to show what we could do, not only in terms of revenue, but also from a leadership standpoint. And I was awarded best of the best, which they only honor 100 employees out of Bloomingdale's every single year. I won a best of the best award in terms of delivery, outcomes, leadership, and just overall quality in terms of what we were doing. So that was a wonderful high mark in my career as well, too. And I had visibility to CEO and leadership as well. So I was still very much mid-level senior director of, or senior online director of, senior online director of Bloomingdale's.com. But I had leadership and recognition and visibility to senior leadership all the way up to the CEO level. As a matter of fact, at the time when I started at Bloomingdale's, I was reporting in through Tony Spring, who was leading marketing there at Bloomingdale's. He then became the CEO of Bloomingdale's, and I do believe he's now the incoming CEO for Macy's. So it's relationships, it's networking, it's also just being in the right place at the right time back in 2003.
If you would be open to share maybe some challenging situation that came up and maybe some key lessons you learned from it, some key things that you had to do to overcome some obstacle or some problem.
Yeah, you know, when you're in creative and design as well too, it starts to become very subjective, right? So the work that you're doing and you're presenting to other leaders to get buy-in starts to get very opinionated. And I can't tell you how many discussions, grumblings, arguments I had with leadership or even other partners about button color or size of logo or the size of picture or size of font. These are not the discussions we want to be having, right? This is not value to our organization. So early on in my career, there was this lesson learned about what is the right amount of criticism and feedback we should be taking, what is value in terms of feedback, and what are the things you can throw out the door. That's where I learned that data and feedback really had to be brought to the table to be able to depoliticize and disarm some of those conversations. Because just somebody wants to change the color from red to blue is not valuable feedback. If the user does not like it in terms of size or location or something that they can actually use that makes an effective customer experience, that's feedback I'm going to listen to. So how do you take subjective, prescriptive feedback, but turn it on its head in terms of, hey, this is not the data we should be looking at. Let's come to the table and be anchored in data, research, and insights to be able to make sure we're building the right solution at the end of the day. So kind of getting past that critique and more about anchoring it in the problem to be solved versus I like and I don't like, which is a terrible place to start in any type of design review.
So you feel that there was too much focus on things that were not very important. The focus was not on key things that were important. What were some of the ways you were able to get people to focus on the right things? Because I think that people are listening to us now and some of them are thinking, I have the same problem. Do you have any tips on how I can get people to focus on the right things?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. We had learned early on that, you know, going to the table, these are in the early days of design as well too, digital design. You know, going straight to the table with a pixel perfect design mockup, people get hung up in the aesthetics too early. They're getting hung up in how it looks rather than how it works and understanding the structure and hierarchy and information architecture. And what is the actual usability of something as well too. And these were all key terms and items that were still really in their infancy until they became a little bit more commonplace later in the design world. But getting people past the aesthetics and really digging into what are we trying to communicate to the user? What are we trying them to do? What is the call to action? What is the spur? What do we want them to imply from this message? But also, what's the direct communication in terms of having the right message in the right place at the right time? Let's focus on content strategy and more of the science behind the storytelling versus just marketing fluff and putting messages out there that they don't care about. What is the right message we should be putting at the right place for that to resonate? So coming to the table with data, research, and backing it with actual customer feedback was really our tool to be able to fight back some of the obstructionism and some of the subjective feedback as well, too, about I like this and I don't like this. It's like, well, it's not about that. It's about how it works. And here's actually some of the feedback we're getting from customers to prove that as well. So I always say, make sure you're coming to the table with data. Data will set you free at the end of the day versus wrapping it up in opinion versus opinion versus opinion.
Very good advice. And in terms of science behind storytelling, did you have people on your team that had that kind of background, or you had to spend nights and weekends trying to catch up on what is happening in terms of data, backing up certain things and how you use science to be better at storytelling?
Yeah, that came a little bit later, you know, in my career as well, too, as we started putting core metrics and these other type of early analytics platforms as well, Adobe. And there were a lot of things that we started to put in place to really start bringing the data. But in terms of science behind the storytelling, what I mean by that is that content strategy, now I'm not talking about marketing content strategy and writing those types of things. I'm talking about content writers or UX writers sitting with research, sitting with information architects within a UX team, going through the journey of a customer, understand what message am I putting here? What is that friction point that I need to remove? What is that don't make me think moment that I need to take out for the user that's more explicit, clear, plain English in terms of the communication that provides a better journey and provides context to what they're doing in terms of their journey? Because people don't read, people scan, and they have to get it very quickly in terms of an experience. It needs to be invisible, it needs to be logical, it needs to be intuitive, but also needs to be explicit in a lot of ways too, in terms of you need to do this at this point. Anytime you have a don't make me think moment where it's like, oh, should I click that? Oh, what does that mean? There's a problem, right? So when I say science behind the storytelling, it's really more content strategists working with their partners to build a better experience.
Yes, I understood it. I know what you mean because I built a couple of sites myself, not personally, although I built a site myself too, but nothing to be proud of. But I have worked with designers and so on, so I know what you mean. I was just using your language so that it is
sure.
So you understand what I'm asking. I wanted to dive a little bit here because you have such a fascinating background. Not every day you speak to someone who designed a site for Bloomingdale's. If you're able to share, were there some situations where data supported something, but then you noticed that customers actually were reacting differently than you anticipated? Any stories you could share like that?
Not at Bloomingdale's, but I can say at Home Depot. And so with my experience at the Home Depot, fifth largest e-commerce site, we were growing that business $1 billion a year, year over year. We grew the mobile app from 700 million to 2 billion. We were always going head to head with some of our brand partners, right, within Home Depot that were managing the categories or category managers. So we had the data to show and plenty of data. We were very data rich at the Home Depot about the journey that customers were taking. And most of the journey started on their phone and then led into an in-store conversion as well. And then, you know, obviously our e-commerce business was super strong, but it was always having the conversation about, what are we actually putting in front of the customer? And I can remember one example specifically on Father's Day, where we were planning for our Father's Day campaign and we were starting to get ready for what that journey looked like and what that program looked like. Category managers decided to put in the first slot for Father's Day a hot water heater. And I went back to the category manager. I said, I don't know about you, but I don't know who's buying their father a hot water heater for Father's Day. I said, can we rethink what we're actually putting in front of the customers? Then the next one right next to that was a $2,000 car jack. I was like, who is going out and spending $2,000 on a car jack as a Father's Day more than a hot water heater? So this is where you have to get honest with people and have conversations, not be afraid to push back and say, is this the best customer experience? Are we talking to ourselves? Or are we talking to our customer? So, you know, I love that example because we weren't thinking at the customer level, the user level. We were thinking at the Home Depot level. It's like, oh, I have hot water heaters to sell that I need to move. I'm going to put that in the first slot. That's not a gift for Father's Day. What are we doing?
Such a great story. So for our listeners, a portion of our audience run their own businesses and they have their own websites. Some of them run in consulting firms. I was wondering if you could give them a couple of tips on how they can improve, let's say, a consulting firm website, anything that comes to mind. I know it's kind of general situation, so hard to give advice, but anything you could share.
I think if you have a consulting firm website, it's going to come down to content, because there's so much competition out there. And how do you separate yourselves from the pack? So not only having good, sharp, branded content, what's your differentiator as well too? What's your X factor that makes you stand out? So having really good quality writing, like we were saying earlier about putting the right message in the right place, having a sharp SEO strategy as well too, as you think about the language and keywords and canonical logic and XML sitemaps and everything that goes into an SEO strategy. So thinking through that as well too. And then really also, what is the journey that somebody is coming through? What does somebody want to get out, or what is the outcome that you're expecting and building into that? What are the personas that are coming into your site? Really identifying who those people are and developing crisp personas to say, this is the type of makeup or person that we're expecting to come in, or company to come in and talk to us. How do we tailor that journey for that particular person and make sure that we have the right information in the right place at the right time? So those are some table stakes things that I think should be in place to really prove not only the quality content, but also the length of time they're going to spend with you. There better be something in there worth of value that they're going to reach out in contact, say, yeah, your company interests me. I'm going to reach out and fill out this contact form right here. It needs to be easy. It needs to be intuitive, and it needs to be logical.
Very good advice. Thank you, Paul. So what do you think will be happening now with the website design and the customer journey that will be predominant? Because I'm thinking back, for example, to 2000 and the way websites looked then and the way websites look now is so different. Where do you think we are going in terms of what it will look like?
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting journey the last 25 years, because I was there from the beginning. We went through Flash, which was a wonderful experience, and building these big, beautiful Flash websites that did a lot of great things, but the user experience generally sucked. And then mobile design was the next big thing around 2011, 2012. And then mobile app design went through that. Now we've been through the journey of Photoshop, the Sketch, to Figma in terms of the tools that everybody was using. We saw Adobe buy Figma, and then Figma and Adobe break up this week as well too. So now everything is starting to centralize around AI. And so that's the next big shiny red button in terms of what AI is going to do for web design and UX design in general. And how does that actually improve a designer's job, but also not cannibalize a designer's job at the same time? So right now, while there hasn't been an iPhone moment in terms of the one big thing that's going to come through and disrupt, and we're all going to rally around this particular tool that creates websites automatically and creates branded content and creates big, beautiful images and holistically pulls that together, I still don't think we're there. I think we're quite a few years away. And frankly, you still need a human touch, because to stay competitive, designers really have to offer the skills that can't be automated. So with machines right now are not going to understand behaviors and patterns and human emotion. We're not there yet. We'll get there probably eventually. It's coming. We can see that. But right now, we have to offer those uniquely human and creative skill sets to be able to use AI as a companion species to build this product or this thing at the end of the day. So it's coming. While we see things like Midjourney, DALL-E 2, Adobe Firefly, this is a big topic of conversation among companies right now. And frankly, I was out in San Francisco over August, met with the head of design at Adobe, and that particular day, he had 9 meetings just about AI itself. That's it, all about AI. So they're doubling down in terms of what AI investment looks like, but that's the thing to watch now in terms of what's everything going to look like as well too, and what is the internationally doing in terms of competition? Because generally, some countries are further ahead of us in the U.S., and that was something we did at the Home Depot as well too, is that we would go to Asia and investigate what they were doing there, because generally, they were a year and a half ahead of everything else, and they were mobile only, and they were using QR codes for everything, and everything was integrated through WeChat. So what is that unifying platform as well that's going to combine everything? But AI is really something to watch now in terms of how that affects not only our jobs, but also experiences and sites to be built.
For someone who is around 35 years old, they are relatively senior within the organization. They have a team under them. They are successful. Given where we are going with AI, what would you recommend they do to remain relevant and in demand?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say, first of all, upskill wherever you can. So send your teams for training and development, find the courses you can take or boot camps, or get a good understanding, start getting some tools into place for your team to start building and banging on in terms of learning what's working, what's not working. So any sort of upskill development is always a good thing, because then they feel like they're not being stagnant in their careers. They're learning and they're growing. And also making sure that you have career paths in place as well, too. Having crisp goals, roles and responsibilities, differentiators that they can grow into. And it's also being slightly entrepreneurial as well. If you've got those two or three people that are really your innovators or like to tinker or take new tools and take that across an organization, that's a great thing. And you know, we did that at Home Depot. I had one gentleman who was our chief tinkerer, if you will, and he was investigating ARKit through Apple, and that became the beginning of the AR experience through our mobile app. So I think it's allowing creatives to be bored, allowing creatives the time to think and sit, and allowing creatives the time to explore, because that could be your next big tool or game changer within an organization. It worked for us at Home Depot, and I empower teams to do that as well, too, to help grow their careers, but also feel like they've got skin in the game and a voice at an organization.
Well, and in terms of upskilling, are there specific skills you would recommend they focus on?
Right now, I would say, you know, investigate Midjourney, DALL-E 2, any of these new tools that are out there about how AI is automating the process. So any of these tools that you can get your hands on, ChatGPT, of course, as well. Not everybody, but a lot of people are starting to use that and investigate that. But not for eye candy, not for using AI just to use AI, but how can you map it back to some sort of value, right? Is it providing value for your organization? I think that's the one thing nobody's really figured out yet, is that, okay, we know AI is a thing. We know we have to investigate it, and we know it needs to be part of our strategy. It's probably a pillar as well, too, and probably every single corporate deck out there. But what's the thing that's going to drive value for the company at the end of the day, and how is it going to be used? So that's the thing I think people have to connect back to, is that, okay, yeah, I understand how to use the tools. What is the value that it's driving? But then how does it map into the bigger strategy? What sort of KPI or broader investment does it map back to say this is providing value for a company at the end of the day? So that's where business leaders have to work together and say, hey, this AI tool design thing you're using over here, what is that doing for my organization? Was it building, or is it just eye candy right now?
So for someone who, let's say they are a partner within a large consulting firm, and given that profile, would you adjust your recommendation, or would it be the same?
With a partner in a large consulting firm, you know, we know that AI, we're working with a large consulting firm right now called Deloitte at SCAD. And Deloitte is one of the biggest consulting firms, as we know. And they are investigating AI, and they're making it a priority. So I think if you're a leader in a consulting firm right now, you need to make AI a priority. How that manifests depends upon your business goals and outcomes and strategy, of course. But this is something that larger companies need to get their arms around in terms of how it's affecting their business. So I would say, get together, form a strategy. What does that strategy look like that differs from others? And what are the key outcomes that you're trying to get? Like, what are the actual measurements of AI? What are you trying to do with it at the end of the day? So the race is on. The gold rush is on. But I don't think anybody has found that iPhone moment yet that really unifies us and say, this is the thing we should be doing.
Does AI concern you in terms of where we are going and how we will be impacted?
Good question. Like I mentioned earlier, there is this concern about our roles being cannibalized. Will design jobs go away down the road? So that concerns me as well, too. And we just finished a project at SCAD with a very large design organization, and it was all around AI. And I think the interesting thing through that project was that students kept a very human-centered approach to it. So it wasn't AI taking over, but AI working as a companion species to day-to-day activities. So AI, I'm excited about it. It scares me a little bit at the same time, but I don't think we're at a point right now where it's going to cannibalize everything. You still need that human touch to understand the problem, wants, needs, frustrations, behaviors, et cetera. That human touch and inquiry to understand the problem that needs to be solved. There's some automation that could be done by AI, which is great. If it speeds up our jobs and increases speed to market, that's terrific. But for me right now, we still need a human touch. So it's coming, but we're not there yet.
Coming back to skills. So for someone who, let's say, a partner at a large consulting firm or an executive within a large organization like Home Depot or a large bank and so on, or a large tech company. So other than understanding AI tools and how to use them and then how to create value for your organization, what other skills you think people should be focusing on developing that AI for a long time at least will not be able to replicate to have?
So yeah, I think that comes into understanding user research as well and a human-centered approach, but also understanding design thinking and taking design thinking to a strategic level as well too, because I'm quoting a friend of mine, but the worst thing about design thinking is that the word design is in the title. And so the companies that are taking a design-led approach, and we know who they are, you know, Nike, Google, Airbnb, these companies are leading the S&P by 228% for the last 10 to 15 years. So if there is a way for executives to bring design thinking or a design-led mentality to the table and start out very small with an MVP or minimum viable product in terms of how that looks across an organization, that could solve some big problems, not only internally for a company, but externally as well too. And we found a lot of success like that at the Home Depot too. So I would say if you could bring design thinking to the table, it would be a great way to change behaviors, change mindsets. And there's a lot of benefits to it as well too. It's inclusive. One of the most powerful pieces of design thinking is that it brings everyone to the table on a project. And you're not coming together to draw, you're coming together to solve a problem. And that's where you have to be very clear that there is value in this type of execution. It creates empowerment. So design teams become the guide and teacher to others. So it allows you to go in and become the center of the process and teach other people how to be creative again, which is cool. Then, of course, design thinking it's a way to solve anything. You know, teams really go into a deeper problem. So it's not just about digital design or creative. Design doesn't even have to be part of the output. It could be used for organization, processes, facilities. How to solve AI within our organization? Well, how is that going to be used? So you can really use this as a tool to connect AI back to the bigger picture. It can even be used for government services as well too. And then finally, it's really valuable as a Trojan horse or secret weapon. So if you really want to create change in an organization, you have to change the way people think and the way they behave. So that was the same thing at the Home Depot. Look, the Home Depot is always going to be a product-led and merchant-led organization, full stop. Right, this is never going to be a design-led organization, but taking it all the way up, not only from the grassroots level, all the way up to the executive leadership team, that really changes the behaviors, the mindsets, and getting the buy-in. And when we were facilitating a design thinking session with Home Depot C-suite, and no pressure, you got your C-suite sitting in the room, and I'm leaning into my chief financial officer, and I'm telling him to push past the obvious. He's looking up at me and saying, we should work like this all the time. I said, I know. And you know, so that's value at the end of the day in a different way. And I always like to say that you really need to be a bit of a punk to help create change too and reformat behavior. So you have to have the fortitude to really be go in and challenge the status quo. So take your leadership qualities and really dig in and be a bit of a punk to help create change.
For someone who is listening now and they heard of design thinking, but they're not sure what it is, could you explain for someone who doesn't have the background?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, design thinking, like I said earlier, is a human-centered approach to solving problems. And at the core of design thinking is really this empathy. And you need to have empathy to understand the problem that you're trying to solve. So design thinking was started in the 60s. It was refined in the 90s by IDEO. And now companies, traditional companies, are starting to catch on to it that, hey, this is something that we could use as a tool to be able to change behaviors. And there's several steps included in design thinking, is that it's empathize, define, test, prototype, and then launch as well. So it's a very simple process, but I think the thing that gets conflated or misunderstood is that you have to be able to draw. And it's not necessarily about drawing. It's really about understanding what the problem is to be solved. So the benefits of it are like what I mentioned before. It creates this inclusivity. It creates this idea of empowerment, but also allows you to learn through inquiry. So it's an opportunity to test, learn, and iterate and get better at what you're doing, but also provide speed as well. So that's what we love about design thinking, is that it really allows you to look at a problem in the spaces where you don't necessarily go, and asking questions, and really bringing it all back to the user at the end of the day and understanding their wants, needs, frustrations, and behaviors.
You earlier mentioned you work with Deloitte, which is a huge consulting firm. And I was wondering if you are able to share some of the things you are doing with Deloitte that is connected to design thinking, because I think there will be a great example we can give at this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So SCAD has been working with Deloitte for about 5 years. And the Deloitte Foundry, which we launched earlier in 2023, builds on these years of collaboration and signifies an exciting new chapter in the alliance between our preeminent university for creative professionals and one of the nation's leading professional services firm. Deloitte saw the light back in 2019 and realized what SCAD had to offer in terms of our capabilities and skill set. And so when we think about the expansion of Deloitte Foundry, it's really an extension of everything that we've done. And every time we do a project with Deloitte, design thinking is at the center of our format. That's what SCAD Pro is about. We're using design thinking to solve problems for large Fortune 500 companies. So there's really several pillars to the Deloitte Foundry, not only in terms of doing over 25 projects and getting students hired into Deloitte as well too, but the renaming of the Deloitte Foundry, which was originally Ruskin Hall, it really shows us what a partnership can be as we continue these initiatives where not only do we have Deloitte at the center of what we do, but we've got our admission center and Career and Alumni Success and SCAD Pro and SCAD Amp, which is our professional presentation studio. We've also stood up what's called the Deloitte Rapid Implementation Studio, which is an ongoing year-round studio focused on rapid implementation for specific Deloitte assignments. So multidisciplinary teams of SCAD and students come together with faculty to immerse themselves in real-world business challenges and develop groundbreaking solutions in new technology through human-centered design. So that could be around AI or blockchain or NFTs. So we stand up about 10 of those a year. Digital Frontier Studio is another area where we invest in research. So quarterly studio powered by Deloitte that focuses on research design and implementation strategies. There's the Deloitte Concierge Recruiting Center. So a dedicated on-site resource to mentor and recruit high-performing SCAD students. So this is where Deloitte professionals can come in, meet with our students, review their portfolios, review their resumes, build networks, and hopefully get hired, which backs into our mission of preparing students for their creative profession. And then finally, we have our ongoing SCAD Pro Innovation Studio. So about every quarter, we're on the quarter system at SCAD. We do about 4 to 5 projects. So they're going to continue investing in this in terms of doing about 10 to 12 projects per year through 2028, exploring innovative design solutions through design thinking. A lot of it I can't talk about because it's NDA, but it's in the government and public sector. To put a finer point on that, these are big, meaty, complex problems that we're trying to solve about Social Security, space launches, wayfinding at LAX airport, child welfare, public housing. Like I said, you can solve anything through design, but these are the things that we're looking at and that Deloitte is coming to us to solve through design, which is really exciting.
Well, so coming back to our example of a listener right now, a partner at a large consulting firm, maybe you could give a specific way they could use design thinking this week.
Start small. Start an MVP. Is there a problem that you're trying to solve within your organization? Look, you know, design thinking, there's a lot of tutorials, there's a lot of information out there, but how do you take it back on day one? It's really going back to what is the problem you're trying to solve. And so if you can really break that down and get the right people in the room together and use some exercises, there's tons of exercises out there that you can run. A lot of what we did at Home Depot was based on the book Sprint by Jake Knapp, and then really taking that and making it our own. But if there are individual assignments you want to do, like a 10 for 10, where you're getting 10 ideas within 10 minutes from everybody in the room, or you're doing a crazy 8 sessions where you're sketching out what a particular problem could look like in 8 quadrants, where you're doing one sketch per minute, it's really these fast, fun, interactive, collaborative, asynchronous and synchronous exercises that allow you to get to the root of a problem. So instead of you sitting in a room for 3 hours and brainstorming and writing on large flip charts, you know, which drives me crazy, there's other ways to be creative in terms of how you get to the problem. It's really just letting your hair down a little bit and digging into other types of tools and experiences that can get you there. So there's tons of information and resources out there about exercises you can run that are more effective in brainstorming than your traditional manners.
I have one example of a problem that I hear from our clients who are partners at large consulting firms. And the problem is that now with remote work, they don't get as much time in person with clients, and it's harder to build the relationships. Any advice on how they could use design thinking, or any advice on how they can solve this problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of tools out there right now, which are collaborative design tools. And I use the word design in a way more for problem solving, which really came out of the need of the pandemic. So when we all went into remote working, there was this need for how are we going to work together in a whiteboard situation to collaborate and solve problems. Enter Miro and Mural as that solution. Miro really coming out as the winner, but set up a Miro board and get your clients in there and your partners in there to collaborate. Again, it's not about drawing, it's about ideation. And so you can create a collaborative session within a Miro board, which is basically just a digital whiteboard to pull ideas together, whether it's through post-its or different exercises or note writing. You can all be in there at the same time and contribute to an idea. So if you're going to try something new or break the ice with or build your relationship even further, use collaborative tools to help you get there rather than just having boring Zoom meetings and somebody taking notes and sending out a recap. Get everybody involved through an actual interactive component where they feel like they've got skin in the game, they're contributing, and they have a voice as well. And you can actually see real outcomes at the end of the day. It's like, oh, we actually did this, and we can vote on it and say, we all see where the heat map is going, and we all agree and ratify this particular thing that we just brainstormed for the last 45 minutes. So again, like I said, there's plenty of resources and tools, but I would say launch a license of Miro board ASAP to get that going.
So we have a few minutes left. Maybe you could share with us one example from your time with Home Depot that you feel we need to share here, maybe some key lesson or some big challenge you were able to overcome.
Yeah, you know, I can easily talk about Home Depot and all the successes we had there in terms of the growth of the business, the interconnected experience. There's two examples. One, when the pandemic hit, we were caught flat-footed. And the new normal now was curbside pickup. And how am I going to get the product into my car without going inside, talking to somebody, or touching anything? That's a big problem to solve when you don't have any infrastructure or planning in place. A lot of companies were already doing it, so they had it, which was great, like Target. But we had to stand it up pretty quick. It was one of those rare instances where leadership actually got out of the way and gave us the opportunity to actually drive through, pun intended, and create a curbside experience. Now, it wasn't that easy because curbside pickup is not something you just stand up at the Home Depot. You've got about 50 teams you got to pull together between design, product, engineering, logistics, supply chain, store, brand managers, you know, because not every Home Depot is the same in terms of staging. The parking lot's not the same in every single one. What does that look like? So we had to really bring everybody together to have a voice and then test and learn. So we stood it up quickly and ugly and not good in five stores. And that was our motto. It's like, don't let great get in the way of good. It does not have to be perfect, right? Slow and perfect is not as good as fast and good, right? So what we did is we stood it up quickly, and you had some store managers being very entrepreneurial, taking a Home Depot bucket, sticking a yardstick, and writing a handwritten sign, curbside pickup this way. So as we tested, as we learned, as we ate our own dog food, as we learned from customers as well, and as we got to the point where marketing could catch up or the interface could be better, which parking spot do I need to go to? How do I want to deliver it to my car? We kept iterating and getting better. So there was also this pushback from leadership that, hey, curbside is not necessarily on brand. Well, the customer is saying otherwise because this is the new normal. So going back to what I was saying earlier, getting away from the subjective feedback and bringing it back to the customer's pain points, that's how you break through some of that corporate obstructionism. So that was a good example of where we succeeded. Leadership got out of the way in many ways. And we went from five stores to 10 stores to 100 stores to all 2,000 stores. And curbside pickup is really one of the best features we ever built while we were there. The second one I'll refer to is less about a thing that we built, and it was really more about how we change behaviors and mindsets. The way we scale design thinking across Home Depot, like I said earlier, is always going to be a merchant-led organization, but it was about solving problems through design thinking. And look, it was a very organic grassroots effort. We pissed a lot of people off along the way, but you can't argue with the data in terms of what we delivered in value and speed to market, because if you're not pissing people off, then you're not innovating. And in 2017, it started as a very grassroots entrepreneurial and punk effort, starting with design sprints at the inline and feature level with our teams with an interconnected experience. To get more organized, we codified through a center of excellence, created dedicated support for people to run design sprints. Then we established several lieutenants within my organization and enlisted other like-minded people in the cause. By 2018, we had scaled the program across different departments, going to supply chain and finance and across different squads and communities that were working our interconnected experience. We created internal training and enlisting facilitators. We got invited to the Google Design Sprint Conference because the other companies were catching wind of everything that we were doing at the Home Depot. And then 2019, we figured out a way to scale this in terms of creating different types of sprint offerings and what were traditional, what were new, what were custom. We became design as teachers, and we enlisted Home Depot University to create design thinking 101 classes for people that wanted to leverage the methodology. We started hitting the conference circuit for UX strategy and how design and Google. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, we did one with the executive leadership team. And it doesn't get any bigger than that, but this is what the changing mindset. That was the defining moment in my career to say, we brought design to a strategic level at a company that will never be design led. So for me, that is actually the best story I like to tell from my career at Home Depot and just my career in general. Sure, I could talk about all the great KPIs and numbers and printing money, but changing that, that's the one I'm most proud of.
Well, was there something that you wish I asked you and I didn't? Now will be a great time to share that.
That's a great question. Why don't you ask me about punks and pinstripes?
Let's do it. Tell us about that.
Okay, Punks and Pinstripes is a private network of entrepreneurs, intrapreneurs, and punks. So I've used the word punk several times in this. So to put a finer point on that, it's a networking group where it's a group of us that we have built things that are objectively badass and awesome. So it was founded by my good friend, Greg Larkin. He wrote a book called This Might Get Me Fired. And This Might Get Me Fired was one of the most influential books in my career. And I recommend it to everybody that's listening to this podcast because it will change your life. Greg and I became fast friends. We were introduced at a conference called How. We were all speaking and we were introduced through a mutual friend. And I read Greg's book and I was like, you know what? This book is exactly what I'm doing at the Home Depot. You're just using different language. You know, punks are able to push freedom and the innovation that is necessary in an organization where it's rarely authorized, going back to what I was talking about regarding Home Depot. And punks, we look at each other to achieve, support, and resolve. And so, you know, for us, it's really about pushing the innovation for freedom as well, too. You know, some of our key principles include outcomes over output. You know, in a large company, it's easy to say no to an idea because no one risks anything when they say no to an idea. But like I was saying earlier, within Punks and Pinstripes in the Home Depot, you create these secret societies. So the intrapreneur who acts alone is generally going to be fired or forgotten. So you have to get people who think like you, but also share your mindset and enlist them in the cause. And you really need to create this team of missionaries and mercenaries, missionaries who believe in the big picture of the company and the values, but the mercenaries who are also working hands-on, sleeves up, getting shit done at the end of the day. You need that kind of blend because they believe in the big picture and they have a voice, but they're getting things done. And then finally, having this executive evangelist or godfather or godmother, and that's that executive that has a track record of launching products and in a startup mentality or experience. So they're going to use their executive power, create change, and leave a legacy of transformation. So that opens up a road for you to drive a Mack truck all the way through and create innovation as well, too. And I think that the true value of a godfather or godmother or executive evangelist is that when something goes sideways or breaks, they're going to be a person that will take a bullet for you and say, kill me first. Because when the shit hits the fan, they're going to step up and say, hey, I got this. And they're going to remove the roadblocks. They can navigate politics and corporate obstructionism and really lead the way. So all of us believe in that theory. We've all been there. We've all had that executive evangelist, but we've all been punks at some point in our career. So like I said, read the book. This Might Get Me Fired. It'll change your life.
Thank you, Paul. Any final words you want to share with our audience? And then where can people learn more about you? Anything you want to share?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for having me on the show today. I do appreciate it. This was a fun conversation. If you'd like to connect with me, find me on LinkedIn. That's where I live. If you'd like to learn more about SCAD and SCAD Pro and the potential partnership and our capabilities, feel free to email me at pstonick@scad.edu or direct message me on LinkedIn. Feel free to visit scad.edu/scadpro as well for more information. And thank you again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. And I think LinkedIn would be very pleased to know that you said that you live there. I'm sure they would be delighted to know that people talk about being on their platform that way. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing all your advice and your experience. You have such a fascinating career, and I really like what you're doing and what you have done up to now. I'm looking forward to see the great things you will continue doing. For everyone watching and listening, our guests today have been Paul Stonik, and I look forward to connect with you all next time.